Good morning. Let me call the study session of Thursday, November 29th to order. I know I need to excuse Councilmember Summers. I assume that Councilmember Whalen's probably on his way. Let's go ahead and first item is to review the items for the December 3rd, 2007 regular council meeting. So you want to grab that information in the packet. First page, I think, is just the welcome and introduction. Page 2. We have the West Main Street plan, which we're going to be talking about this morning. So public hearing on it. Anything on page 1?
Mayor, just yes. One item. On item number 3, I just wanted the council to know one of the things that we would like to do, we haven't had a chance to talk to the full council about this, and we can do this maybe as part of the public hearing or another study session. We would like to have the council consider adding about $500,000 to the bond program with that 12-lead EKG, and we would put that in. We would come talk to the public safety committee about that. But if we're going to have a public hearing, we wanted to make sure maybe at least that was included. What that would allow our today we don't have the technology. We have the older technology today. There's newer technology out there that allows us to have get better information, especially those who are possibly experiencing some kind of cardiac arrest. And this has been a recommendation that's come to us from the group of medical doctors in the area who we respond and who help us respond to those kind of medical emergencies. This would provide, we estimate, about 60% of the total first responders that we have that would be able to put this equipment in there, in the apparatus. And so that's what we're proposing to do. We can talk more about this maybe. We would certainly want to go to the Public Safety Committee, and maybe you could visit with them more about that. But I wanted to at least put it out there so that when we have the public hearing, that would be included. So that's just, I wanted to give the council an update on that.
Okay. I think running through the Public Safety Committee, I've heard good response about it, but I'm not sure how much additional training there is and what additional costs may come with advancing to that type of technology. But from the medical community and being able to send that information to the hospital up front when there's an ambulance run and have them prepared to do the proper type of response when they arrive, it seems to me that cuts down the time frame that we're always talking about on that critical nature from heart attacks and the rest. They can diagnose it much faster. So.
Exactly. And because of the public hearing coming up, I wanted to mention that, and then certainly we can vet it out some more with the Public Safety Committee and the council as we move forward.
Okay. And if it's in the bond package and there's something else that comes up, we don't have to necessarily buy it or authorize it at a future date. It just gives us the authority to do so.
Yes. Capacity. But the public, yes, exactly.
Okay. All right. That would be under number 3 that you're making that comment on. I thought that the 3.1B, the last sentence in that, the purpose of this plan to is encourage residents' participation in providing ideas, comments, and input for local knowledge of the area. I'm trying to figure out, we're doing a resolution and that's the purpose? I mean, they always have the option of contacting the council and doing those things, so it sounds like a political speech, not something that should be in a resolution. So what's the intent?
Mayor, we can sure take another look at that. I think that was really probably referring more to the purpose of the plan and not the resolution. And the planning process has allowed people to do that. So that may be some wording we've pulled from someplace else that maybe for this purpose should be modified just a little bit.
I didn't think it fit in there. I've just never seen it expressed that way. It's more like the brochure you hand out. It's not the resolution that you come up with. Right. So take a look at that one, if you would, please. And that's page 2. Page 3, get into liquor license applications. Page 4, contracts. Continuing on page 5, I've been informed that you have a potential conflict on 5E and F, so I'll turn that over to Vice Mayor. Vice Mayor?
Well, I'm raising my hand to call on myself. It's on 5F, the South CAP Reservoir Booster Pump Station. This is a major project, and I think that I saw some things sitting on our desk about it, and I think we really need to talk about it for a minute and just let everybody know what's going on.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. Excuse me one moment, please, Beth. Councilmember Hewitt.
I just want to say I'll probably have a conflict on this one, too.
Okay, thank you. Good morning. Beth Huning Engineering, and to my right is Gordon Hawes, the supervising engineer for the project, and to my far right is Bill Haney with Utilities. And we put together a few slides this morning to talk about this project. It is a $26 million reservoir that we will be installing to provide potable water to the growing sections of Southeast Mesa. And it is actually the first phase of a larger project. So this morning we thought we'd bring the information to you and let you know how we're going to be providing potable water to Southeast Mesa. Bill's going to cover kind of the master plan components of the project, and then we'll come back to this project and how it fits into the overall project we'll be building at Signal Butte and Elliott.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. Every several years, we update the master plan for the water and wastewater systems in Mesa. The most recent one we completed was done in around in the neighborhood 2002 to 2004. And one of the things we identified at that point in time was a constriction in capacity in the southeast part of the area, which is our future major growth area. We looked at several options for providing service to the area, and that included expanding the North CAP plant, building infrastructure to feed to the south area, or building a second plant in the southeast part of the city. We opted for the southeast plant for several reasons. One, it improves water quality in the future. We've got some disinfection byproduct rules we have to deal with. It provides the pressure and the volume that we need in the southeast area, and it also provides us with some redundancy. In other words, we can have one of our plants out now and still be able to provide surface water services to the eastern part of the city. What we're doing with this project is we're doing it in a phased approach. At this point in time, if you look at the area in Southeast Mesa, there is not a lot of demand out there. However, there is peak demands during the morning. So what we're looking at is doing the first phase of this water plant, which would be a pump station and reservoir to provide for those peaking requirements, with the intent of going back in about 5 to 8 years and constructing the water treatment plant to go with it, which would kind of complete the project. This phase is the pump station, reservoirs, some of the site development work that will be needed for the future plant, and then some ancillary facilities that would go with the future. We just put this slide up. I'm sure many of you have probably seen this numerous times. It's just a system drawing of how our system is laid out. The different colors represent different pressure zones, and you can see that as we go from west to east, there's a number of zones that are related to the altitude of the city. Everything in the pink on the very west is city zone. It's served by the Val Vista water plant, which is SRP water. And everything to the east of that is served by cap water or at sometimes wells. And you can see it's a fairly large area, and right now we're just serving it by the one water treatment plant. The proposed plant in the southeast part of the city would kind of spread out that load somewhat and provide for better water service overall. This is just an indication, again, of what we do have at this point in time. At Val Vista, that plant was originally, I looked the other day, the agreement was originally signed in 1960 to build the plant, and it came online in 1972. With a total capacity of 80 MGD, of which Mesa owns 20 MGD. Currently, after the last expansion in the late 1990s, the plant sits at about 220 million gallons a day, and we own 90 of that. Of the cap plant, it was originally built in 1985, and it's recently expanded to 72 million gallons a day. And that probably will be the maximum that we will ever expect from that facility. The facility we're talking about this morning is master planned in our master plan for 32 million gallons a day with initially with an 8 MGD reservoir and pump station. However, we have, while it doesn't show on the master plans, we have the capability of adding a significant amount more to that facility should we have a change in southeast planning area or decide to serve other areas that currently are not being served by the city of Mesa.
Bill? What does a significant amount more mean? Like, how many more residents could you serve with that?
I don't know if I can give it numbers real easily. We could easily go from 32 million gallons a day up to 48 million gallons a day. We could probably play with either the footprint or with the technology that we would be using. We might be able to get somewhat more, not a significant amount more out of it. But we can get at least 48, which would be, what, another 800,000 people, I suppose.
Okay. And Vice Mayor, and if Bill, this kind of relates to another topic we're going to talk about later this morning, but we are looking at this as a capacity as we look at ultimate build-out, and specifically including what you're going to see later under the Mesa strategic plan are the different scenarios of build-out in the southeast part of Mesa, and how do we have the capacity ultimately to get there. But my understanding is on the wastewater treatment plant, what this will do is allow us to treat the water up to
the 2,000
to the available total amount of available water rights that we have.
Yes, that's correct.
That we currently have today. Is that, am I saying that
that's
right?
That's correct.
That is correct.
The 32 or the 48?
32.
The 32.
So anything above that,
we have to have.
We would need additional water rights.
Right. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Going on, if we look at the project as a whole, this phase is actually just a small part of the overall project. You will be seeing other sections and parts of this coming forth here in the near future. We have, if you start clear to the far right on this drawing, we will be constructing a turnout on the CAP canal to allow us to divert water to the plant. We are starting design of that structure. We are limited to when we can get into the canal and build, so we kind of have to work that in first to get that built. We're looking at building that in the dry up in 2009. Going along west, you see that we have a pipeline coming along Elliott Road. We have acquired and obtained all the easements to put that pipeline in place, and we're looking to start design first of next year. And moving on to the treatment plant itself at Signal Butte and Elliott, you see it's just south of SRP's Browning substation in that area. And this will be the first phase of the plant that we're bringing forward. The second phase of the plant will be coming later. If we look at the site itself, you can see it there. We are also in the process of drilling two wells. We've drilled one of the two wells. One is just to the south there and kind of north of Elliott and west of Mountain Road. The other is further north on the site. Those wells are being drilled. One is already drilled and one is in the process of being drilled. We'll equip those and pipe those into the reservoir as well. And then looking at the project itself, what we're constructing, the phase we're constructing today, you can see is an 8 million gallon cast-in-place concrete reservoir and a booster pump station to distribute the water out into the system. What that reservoir allows us to do, as Bill indicated earlier, is take water in at night when the demands are low, fill the tank, and use it to peak the next day, as well as to add into our well capacity into that reservoir. We'll also be doing the wall screens and landscaping around the site and the retention and doing some site development as part of this phase.
The 8 million gallon reservoir, you said it's completely enclosed?
Yes, it's buried underground and it's concrete cast in place.
Okay, and when you're doing the area around it that you said you're going to, you know, landscape, and I see that you have potential expansion area there. Is there area there potentially for park usage?
Or yes, actually, if you go back one, right there. Yeah. If you look at the treatment plant, the city owns the entire blue outline space there, Vice Mayor, and the treatment plant itself is only taking what's in the red. This site, I believe, will also have a fire station on it, and there's discussions for other facilities to go on this site. We did meet yesterday with SRP on their power line alignments in and out of that substation, and we're telling them we're reserving all the space on that site that we possibly have for future city facilities that will be programmed over the next few years.
You'll be at a fire site. Go ahead, Bill.
I was going to say, another thing we might mention is there. What's called out as a siphon draw runs right through the middle of the site. Yeah. And that's something we'll have to address as we construct this and maintain that flow. So that it probably is an opportunity for some sort of green space along there and anything that would expand out from that, from the draw itself.
So that's not an open, that's an underground thing, the siphon draw thing is underground?
No, that's surface,
it's a wash.
Washer.
It's a surface wash.
Okay. Yes. And Councilmember Jones.
Just want to also clarify, when you talked about our capacity, that 32 million gallons, that's our CAP capacity. That has nothing to do with our groundwater portfolio and all that. That's
correct.
CAP.
CAP
yes.
only. Okay. And our final slide, we'll show you the full plant at build-out. This contract will be starting design in 2011. There's the current plan, depending on how quickly the area develops, and it will be kind of contingent upon what happens in Southeast Mesa, with estimated construction time of 2014. So.
Additional questions? Councilmember Rawls.
Are we going to be building the pipeline before we do the turnout structure?
Well, the turnout will actually be built first, and the pipeline will be in design during that time.
Because okay. I'm just looking at the timing here. We're talking about finishing the phase one in April of 2009 mm-hmm. on the site, but we're not going to get to the turnout structure until late 2009. And then if we're going to build the pipeline after that.
Yeah. The
tap water.
Go ahead. You want to do that?
The reservoir actually will be taking water through a pipeline that runs across the city and basically down Ellsworth Road from the north CAP plant.
That exists.
What, the turnout and the raw water line is going to be raw CAP canal water.
Untreated.
Okay, and so that'll be eventually used when you get the phase two.
Yeah, that's the water supply for the future treatment
okay.
plant.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, is there anything else you'd like us to know about this? Looks like a good plan. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mayor.
That's concludes on page 5. Let's move over to page 6. Tom?
Item 6B is on the consent agenda. I don't know what it's on the consent for, since it was a recommendation of denial. If it's on the consent agenda, what are we doing?
Mayor, Councilmember Rawls, it's still introducing an ordinance, so when you get to the actual hearing in 2 weeks, you'll have an ordinance that you could approve should you choose to rather than follow the recommendation for tonight.
That's fine. Leave it on consent then.
Vice Mayor.
Yeah, and my question was on the same one. That's a different approach than we used to take. It used to be if it came through with a recommendation for denial. We didn't introduce the ordinance. The council discussed it first. So you're introducing an ordinance now. The neighbors, I was at the Mesa Grande meeting the other day, and I forgot that it was going to be the introduction, and they were very concerned about it being on consent. And I said, well, it's going to get pulled off consent. And I wasn't thinking about consent for introduction. So the time for people to come for the public hearing on this is the second meeting in the month, which will be the 17th of December. So I just want to remind everybody in the neighborhood that was concerned about showing up this coming Monday that the time for the public hearing on it is December 17th. Obviously, people are welcome to come, pull it off, and talk about it, but the real time for the public hearing is the 17th. Thank you.
That's page 6. Page 7 would be resolutions. Push your little button in there, Daryl.
Yeah, just announcing I have to abstain from item 7B.
All right. I have 7A and 7B not highlighted. Do you have both of those?
That.
What's the what was the reason for not having 7A on for consent?
Mayor, I thought there was a potential conflict for Daryl, but I guess not. Mesa Drive and U.S. 60. Well, we can talk after. This is the intersection of Mesa Drive and Southern.
We're doing Mesa Drive and Broadway.
Is it?
Why don't we put 7A back on? We can always pull it prior to the meeting.
We'll discuss it after, but we'll keep it on consent.
All right. And I assume because these are not construction contracts that I don't have a conflict on these two.
Right. Exactly.
Okay, let's just pull 7B then. All right, and that's page 7, page 8.
Items 8C and 8D are contain the provisions that I was uncomfortable with, so I need to have those pulled off the consent.
Mayor, Councilman Rolls, we're asked, we will, we can do that. Notice they're also being continued to the 17th.
Oh, they are too.
But we will do that on the 17th.
I have no problem with leaving them on consent to continue them.
Okay. Mike?
Just for Debbie, I had a conversation with the fire chief this week on these two items, reference to what I talked to, a potential conflict on the fire code. I'll continue my discussions and make my decision by the 17th. That's okay with you?
Let's leave them on as long as they're continued to the 17th. Okay, that works. All right, that's last page on consent or on items for council meeting. Let's go back then to the study session. Item number two is her presentation and discuss alternative land use scenarios for the Southeast Mesa Strategic Development Plan.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. We're back again to really introduce you to the three land use scenarios that the consultant team has been working on for the Southeast, or what we're now calling the Mesa Gateway Strategic Development Plan. A couple of things that I wanted to point out. We understand this is the first time you've seen these maps, and in doing, and as such, we understand that you're going to need time to review them, digest the information, and really study these. And that's why we're giving them to you today, because we expect and we would really hope that in 2 weeks, when we come back again to get formal comments from you and also kick off our two-day workshop, that you'll be really prepared to give us that insight from the council. A couple of points that I'd like to suggest in these alternatives. In the next 2 weeks, our consultant team is really going to be flushing out the details and doing some very detailed evaluation on each of these criteria. These are not standalone plans. If there's elements in one plan that really works well, at that two-day workshop, we really hope to bring together those ideas that work well and make them work in a unified plan. So staff and the consultant team were here this morning, and anytime in the next 2 weeks, if you need to meet with us, we'll make ourselves available. And with that, I'd like to introduce again Mark McLaren to go through the more detailed presentation.
Thank you, Mike. Good morning, Mayor and Council. I'd like to provide you with a brief overview this morning of our continued work on the Mesa Gateway Strategic Plan. As you'll recall at our last presentation to you, we talked about the various elements of work that were underway in a lot of the background data collection and evaluation leading up to the development of alternative land use scenarios, which we had just briefly discussed as a part of that meeting. In doing so, what I'd like to cover today is the continuing technical work, specifically in a couple of areas related to transportation, financing, and the fiscal impact of these various land use alternatives, and then get into some of the detail of what's included within those alternatives that we are currently considering. The work that we had discussed last time in terms of data collection and the information we were coming to better understand as it related to transportation, the opportunities for the airport, the asset that you have in the Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport, was basically serving as our baseline on which to build these alternative plans as we continue to move forward. Very briefly, transportation model is a process that we currently have underway to evaluate the traffic and transportation issues related with each of the three alternatives that we are developing and currently considering. It is a model that is based on a 2030 planning horizon, as that is the farthest out horizon that regionally we have any data available from to really build a transportation model and understand fully what's forecast in the rest of the region for traffic, transportation, and demographics that would affect this area. We are modeling all three of the land use scenarios using a variety of trip generation rates that reflect the different types of uses and forms of development that are being considered, building off of the general plan roadway network that the city has previously adopted. As we're going through this process, we're really looking at a couple of key performance measures as to how each of these scenarios function from a transportation standpoint. Obviously, looking at the typical characteristics of roadway level of service and the number of trips that are generated, but also as we start to look at mixed use alternatives for this area and various forms and patterns of development, we're focused on the ability of this area to internalize trip capture, in other words, have people who live and work within the same area, so you don't have traffic that's being generated going off into other areas of the region. And at the same time, by having an area that's job-rich, the ability to attract trips from the rest of the region into the area. At the same time, obviously, we have the consideration and concern about pass-through traffic from a development in adjacent areas of Queen Creek and Pinal County that would pass through the study area. At the same time, we're also in the process of developing a fiscal impact analysis model. This is a dynamic tool being developed to really help us understand the costs associated with the development of each of these alternatives. It is a model that will be calibrated based on the plans that have been identified, the costs the city has had for similar facilities in the past, and I think this is an important tool to know that will be a product that will be turned over to the city for your staff to use on future projects to help evaluate and understand the costs associated with those. The model will look at the capital costs of the infrastructure and the facilities required to serve the area, along with the operating costs that are associated with those as well, looking at the revenues that are available to help fund and pay for some of those facilities that are required, and understanding the expenses that are incurred over the life of the area as it relates to not only the administration of those services, but also the delivery of them to the study area. In doing so, as we are with the transportation model, we will be evaluating each of the three scenarios independently so that we can compare the relative costs associated with each of the three and look at the different revenue expense scenarios in terms of when costs would be required and for what purpose to help build out the study area. As a part of the development of the land use plans and understanding the value of each of these alternatives, we are also looking at a strategic market analysis based on the previous work that was initiated by Elliot Pollack to continue to look at the economic development concepts that would help add value to this area, specifically understanding the interest of identifying industries and companies that add value through higher wage jobs to the area, as well as take advantage of and build on the asset that you have with the airport and its related infrastructure. As we had discussed previously, given the timeline of the study, the size of the area, the opportunities that exist for economic development are apt to vary over time. There are things that are viable now as it relates to the airport. There are other industries that will be viable more later as other infrastructure and residents start to come to the area and provide some of the necessary workforce and others to make these things happen. We had also discussed previously the initial development that's continuing to evolve on an industry scorecard, a tool for you and city staff to have to understand where energies are best expended in pursuing new industries and opportunities for this area as you look at the ability to market the entire area. This is work that we have been continuing with input from Dr. John Casarda at the University of North Carolina, who was a part of our visioning process back in the end of October, and with his input based on experience from similar facilities around the world, we had identified a number of industries that really focus on the asset of an airport and its environs as an area to locate and set up operations and grow. Elliot Pollack's group has taken that information and folded it into an expanded version of their scorecard, as we had discussed before, and evaluated each of these, and we will discuss these more as well with their staff on the 13th and 14th as a part of our workshop. But as you can see, there's a couple of these industries that really have some good opportunity as it relates to the Mesa Gateway area. There are some of these, though, as well, that are things that historically we have not had as a type of industry or sector in the valley and probably aren't going to be something viable for a period of time. Not to say that they'll never happen here, but when we look at the advantages and the benefits of marketing the area and looking at industries to locate here, they're not the ones for which energies and efforts would be best expended to try to attract to the area. And obviously, fashion garments and jewelry are the two things that stood out as not necessarily being applicable to this area or getting the F. At the same time, we are looking at a number of different financing strategies. Obviously, as we develop a fiscal impact model and as we look at the opportunities that exist for the market, we need to understand how we finance the infrastructure and the other needs that are required to service this area. We're looking at a variety of different techniques, all of which could be used independently or in combination thereof. Given the size of the area and the time that will evolve through its evolution and its growth, it's reasonable to assume that what we come up with will ultimately be some sort of a hybrid funding mechanism and strategy that helps make this area realize its potential. We're looking at a number of different types of categories for financing in terms of some tools, community facility districts, state infrastructure banks, some of which are familiar to this community, some of which are not. And we have also been looking at an institutional mechanism as to how we take and basically administer those various types of funds to make this area continue to grow and realize the infrastructure that's necessary. On a preliminary framework for that institutionalization, one of the things that IMG, our finance consultant partner, is looking at as a part of this is the idea of an enterprise fund established for the purposes of ensuring that there's an ability to collect some sort of fee, impact fee or other associated with making sure that the development that occurs in that area is helping pay the full cost to build, operate, and importantly maintain those services over time as the area continues to grow. At this time, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Tim Rood with Community Design and Architecture to discuss the three land use concepts you have before you this morning. Tim.
Thanks, Mark. Good morning, Mayor and Council. We are in the process of developing three different land use concepts or scenarios for the area. They kind of have different themes. The amounts and types of development vary between the three scenarios. All of them include areas for future growth beyond 2030. As Mark noted, we can't really model things like transportation beyond 2030, and this is such a large area that we know it will take more than 23 years to build out. The three scenarios take varied approaches to transportation in terms of the flight path protection, roadway alignments, and transit options. I'll be showing you some of that. And they also take varied approaches to the provision of open space. You have in your packet illustrations of the three scenarios. Each of these colors basically represents a different set of assumptions. The bulk of these different colors are actually based on your general plan land use categories, with a few additional ones to reflect some of the mixed-use development types. And on each of these drawings, the hatched areas represent the portions that are post-2030 development. So those basically, that would be the long-term build-out option. Some of the themes of the concepts, just a few highlights. Concept A takes a real focus on mixed-use places. It has the highest proportion of housing to jobs. All of these are, you know, very job-rich, but A has the highest proportion of housing. It also has a higher proportion of office jobs as opposed to industrial, and it uses some innovative street network and intersection designs that I'll be showing you a couple pictures of. It has a site-wide continuous open space and trail network, which can also serve to handle a regional approach to stormwater detention. Concept B is more of a market-based conventional development focus. It has greater separation of employment and commercial from residential areas, minimal modifications to the arterial grid, of conventional street hierarchy with access management features, and the concept was to have on-site detention but with locations coordinated. And finally, concept C. This one takes a very assertive approach to industrial development and airport protection as the economic development engine. This one has the highest proportion of jobs to housing. It also has the highest proportion of industrial jobs as opposed to office. In terms of the circulation network, this one, C, has an optimized airport ring road. This is coming out of Professor Casarda's work that's really optimized for truck traffic. In C, this area would be a real major job destination, so very heavy focus of in-commuting, which could necessitate some upgrades to some of the regional infrastructure. So here in the illustrations here, you can see concept A, there's a heavy focus on those circled areas, which are the mixed-use centers. And these are places where offices, retail, and multifamily and other types of residential development could all coexist in an urban, walkable, downtown kind of environment. You can also see in this one the continuous site-wide network of open space with a proposed regional park location at the up against the Superstition Vistas area, and then kind of a continuous trail and open space network through the proving ground and on into throughout the site. Concept B, there's, you know, you can see this one has kind of the most limited job creation program, and we're still obviously right in the thick of refining these numbers, so these are by no means final. And concept C, you can see there's a lot more purple. That's basically reflecting that aggressive industrial development program. So then we'd done a few bar charts just to kind of illustrate how these compare, and I think I would focus more on the relative proportions of, rather than the absolute size of the bars, just kind of note how they compare to each other. So scenario A actually has the most land developed. It also has the most open space. In terms of jobs and housing balance, you can see A and C both have really quite vast numbers of jobs, more than are in downtown Phoenix. We're working to refine these numbers. And you can see A also has about twice as much housing as B or C. In terms of the job types, A has a higher percentage of commercial and office uses. C has a higher proportion of industrial uses. And then again, in terms of the different types of housing, they all contain a mix of different types of housing. A has more housing in those urban mixed-use centers. Oh, and I should mention all the way also that I've just seen some new numbers on the potential demand for attached housing, and actually by some estimates, in 2030 we will have all of the detached housing as a country that we're estimated to need right now. And all of the new demand will basically be for attached and multifamily housing, because there's just relatively little of that in the marketplace. As the baby boomers age, many of them are looking for more urban environments to kind of downsize into. And at the same time, you have the kind of the echo boomers, the children of the baby boomers, who are now really entering the housing market in full force. So there's a lot of demand out there for townhomes and those kinds of attached forms of housing. So these mixes here, where we have approximately a third to a half of the units in detached housing, while they may seem aggressive, are actually very much in line with what the demographics look like. Okay, here we have a couple diagrams of how the various types of transit could work to kind of serve all the travel need that would occur in this corridor. In concept A, we've illustrated a scenario where some form of high-capacity regional transit is operating on Power Road, and then we basically have a kind of an aerotropolis loop that connects to it at Elliott and then again at Williams Field Road, and basically serves most of those mixed-use centers going back and forth around the airport, and then a more local circulator operating in the proving ground area. And concept B, we're illustrating a high-capacity line on Elliott with primary local transit lines running on Power Road and Ellsworth. And then two circulator loops serving the east and west sides of the airport, and both feeding into that central terminal station and tying into the other lines. And then finally in concept C, the concept here is, again, you have
Could you please define the difference between a primary local transit line and a high-capacity regional transit line?
You know, it's a bit fluid. The basic concept is that, you know, we understand that there may only be one high-capacity regional transit line of whatever mode, be it light rail, commuter rail, bus rapid transit, or some other form. But we also know that there will likely be some kind of local transit network operating in the vicinity, right? You know, that will be, you know, be it conventional bus service or, you know, just the regular Valley Metro bus or something like that. And we also understand that given the intensity of development out here, some sort of more localized circulator type vehicle might be needed to serve all.
Well, that's what I was asking, because you also have a circulator on here,
right?
So okay.
And I had some illustrations of the different types of vehicles, but we took them out for reasons of time, so I apologize. And again, these are, you know, very preliminary, but just and they kind of just illustrate some of the different concepts. And then in concept C, we're kind of using that airport ring road as sort of a trunk line, and the idea is that various shuttles or circulators could loop onto that main line around the airport and then loop out to serve the various destinations and the proving ground and the other areas, and then tying into the high-capacity line on Power Road. Just have a few illustrations to close with of some of the street types that we're looking at using in these scenarios. Boulevards and avenues, which would be the one approach to kind of treating the major arterial class roadways. Connector roads, kind of an alternative to the collector, and then local streets. Here's an example of a boulevard, basically a divided roadway, often four lanes, sometimes six lanes, often with bike lanes, often with on-street parking. And the idea here is that this can be an attractive roadway that development doesn't have a problem fronting onto, as you see here. The concept of a connector street is basically trying to maintain that pedestrian environment that's sort of walk-friendly and bike-friendly throughout a large area. And a conventional collector where you get sound walls and back fences and often no sidewalks and fairly wide roadways and high travel speeds doesn't really maintain that pedestrian environment that well. So what we found is that if you can have a fairly connected network of streets that are two lanes and that connect neighborhoods to and employment districts to local destinations, that can really help to extend that walkability for larger areas. We're looking at roundabouts as one way of handling the high turn volumes at major intersections, and these actually can in many ways handle more cars than a conventional signalized intersection, though we may be less familiar with them in this country. They are being used around the country. And finally, we're looking at a innovative approach called a couplet intersection that basically is where you split apart a roadway and have a whole city block within it. I'll show you a picture of one. That's an example. And basically what this does is it kind of breaks down the scale of the major arterials, makes them more pedestrian friendly, and it also actually functions better in many ways from a traffic perspective. I won't go into the details, but basically the idea is that you can make, where you have the one-way system meeting a one-way system, you can make a free left turn, you know, from a one-way to a one-way. So you avoid a lot of those turn cues and the need for the turn lanes, which has the effect of reducing the pedestrian crossing distances and also reducing delays. So with that, I think I'll turn it back over to Mark to discuss the plans for December.
Thank you, Tim. As we have discussed previously, we do have a two-day workshop that's scheduled for Thursday and Friday, December 13th and 14th, coming up in 2 weeks here. We have scheduled an agenda which will give us the opportunity to get input and have substantive discussion not only on these three land use alternatives, but the outcome of the technical analysis that's underway to look at the fiscal impacts, to look at the issues related to financing mechanisms, the transportation impacts, all the things that we're collecting and continuing to analyze as a part of this discussion, as well as understand better the relationship of the open space and the off-street pedestrian opportunity circulation that occur with each of those plans. Our agenda for those 2 days will begin actually with a presentation and briefing to you, Council, that morning to discuss those land use scenarios, and as Mr. James mentioned earlier, have an opportunity for you to provide your feedback and ask a lot of questions about the work and the technical information that we'll present to you that day. We will be following that with our session at the ballroom at the Polytechnic campus with a public presentation, again, of the alternatives and the analysis, and then breakout groups for discussion on each of those alternatives, as well as the various elements of technical work that have been done so that people have the opportunity to gain some of the insight and information from our other technical experts as a part of this team as well. So you will see that in the agenda, for example, in the afternoon, we have a time slotted on the discussion of airport opportunities with Mr. Jeff Kleimans, who is our airport opportunities expert working on this project, so that if you have a specific interest in the discussion of that issue, you know that that's a time that you can come and join us, and we'll facilitate a discussion in that area.
will continue through the day on Friday with the intent of, by the middle of the day, wrapping up with the pieces of developing a consensus plan, if you will, of taking those elements that best represent the interests, the issues, the values of the city of Mesa from those three alternatives and combining them into one plan that we will then begin to refine as a part of this process. Thank you.
Okay, questions on it or input, Kyle?
I may not be remembering well, but when we've had previous discussions about land use around the Gateway area, I thought that we had pretty much decided as a council that the Gateway Freeway was going to be the barrier for residential to keep that whole area open going out to the east. So I was a little concerned because I like the concept of A, but not with the residential south of that freeway area. Because we've been fighting very hard to keep the Gateway open for the helicopter use and so forth going out to the east. So I was a little concerned why, even after our previous discussions as a council, that I still see residential south of that Gateway Freeway.
Well, the point of the three scenarios was to explore alternatives.
Right.
So alternative C has no residential south of the freeway, and it's, you know, basically based on your general plan map.
Right.
You know, in developing the other alternatives, we did work with staff, and we did look at the, you know, constraints that are out there in terms of development that's in the pipeline. But we also looked at opportunities for compatible uses. And, for example, you know, although ASU Poly is not planning on building additional housing south of their campus, if they did decide to, that could have ramifications. They could help with the jobs housing balance in that area, could help, you know, provide student housing and possibly provide, you know, Mesa with some additional sales tax dollars if those students are able to live in Mesa as opposed to living in Gilbert and commuting to school. So that's just one example of one of the things that we were looking at. You know, so we're trying to, you know, create high value mixed use places that are attractive job destinations in scenario A, and part of what makes that work is having, you know, a mix of uses, including, you know, more urban, higher density forms of residential adjacent to places where there's retail and employment, so that you kind of can have a retail base that both of those uses can feed off of, and it makes everything kind of work better.
Yeah, and I like the concept of A. However, that element just will not float with me at all if you have residential below the Gateway Freeway. So, my input.
Tom?
One of the things that would be helpful to me, so I don't have to get out a slide rule and my protractor and all this stuff, is for each of these plans, if you could identify, like over here on the side, how many acres you have for each plan attributable to office, light, industrial, etc. Is that something that is important to me?
Yeah, we have a little bit out of that.
I could sit there for 3.5 days and probably figure it out myself, but I'd rather have you do it.
Yeah, we have a handout like that.
Okay, thank you.
Make available to you.
The draft C you mentioned was basically what our master plan is currently today, with, I think, probably the only one is next to the regional park. I think you have, is that neighborhood commercial or is that high-density residential?
That's high-density residential to the east of the regional park.
Okay, that might be in conflict with that turnout pattern, too, for the fly-friendly procedures and the overflights. So I don't think that aspect fits into the master plan. But my question is, what do you lose? Because we've basically adopted a plan very similar to C currently, with the exception, I believe, of the urban center. I think the urban center would have to slip more to the south. It's also kind of in that half-mile corridor or mile corridor from the power line up. What do you gain by going to either A or B in the job housing ratio? And I didn't quite catch your slide that if we stay with C, that we lose out on an opportunity. What do we lose out on? Just the intensification of the industrial area?
Well, I think, you know, part of, well, by the December workshop, we hope to have a more kind of formal presentation on the trade-offs and benefits of each of the three scenarios. You know, the issue with C is that you're really doing so much to keep residential out of the flight path that you've really constrained the area that can be used for residential, which means you've got a very large area for industrial development that's going to take a very long time to absorb. And so that could have ramifications in terms of the fiscal impacts.
Right. I would presume you would have to somewhat overlay the area that's not within your contours here, because I think basically everything outside of that little dotted line is wide open for residential in any intensity people want to put it in. Queen Creek, I think, is a little lower, but Gilbert is certainly high, and north of the power line is high, and Pinal County is high. So I'm not sure that a 2 or 3 mile commute into a employment center is a long distance that you have to have an urban center immediately upon.
Well, there's actually a lot of research that shows that development has more value in these mixed-use centers than it does in large tracts of just nothing but employment. So that was, you know, one of the concepts we were trying to explore with these mixed-use centers is how to capture that additional value and provide the amenities, the open space, the retail, you know, just proximity to services that both makes a location more valuable to a company to locate in and also makes using transit actually a viable way to get around. If you, you know, if you have to take some kind of transit and then maybe a shuttle to get to your workplace and there's nothing around for miles, you know, it's, you're kind of stranded. So
right. And then the other question, I guess, is how important is the airport? If we make a mistake here and allow a lot of higher density residential and other residential in the area, and we can't get any users for the airport, and it shuts down or becomes a small, you know, a smaller size of airport instead of what we're anticipating for passengers, is it still an economically viable area? Can we plan on not necessarily if we make a mistake and the airport closes, is that a death blow, or is it?
Well, we're certainly not contemplating doing anything that would require the airport to close. And you know, the noise contour is shown on here from your general plan. You know, you're already using a more aggressive, the FAA just doesn't allow residential in the 65 DNEL area, which is that inner red line. You discourage residential in the 60 DNL area, that's a little wider. You know, but that still leaves a lot of area that is not really noise constrained except by the overflight pattern. So, you know, we have aviation people working on right, trying to refine that analysis.
Mayor and Council, as per your request at our last meeting, we are continuing to research and will be prepared to address on the 13th the issues as it relates to the differences between the DNLs, as Mr. Rood has mentioned, and the flight patterns that have been identified by Boeing and others as being important to them for the overflights and the turnout that you were referring to the east from the north end of the runway, so that we can understand the impact of each of these three plans as it relates to the flight protection and where we have encroachments of those areas, what that means in terms of the operation of the airport.
And Mayor, also, I've asked staff, because there seems to be a lot of anecdotal talk about what is the flight path. We've actually are mapping the actual flight path from FAA to show where the planes actually are going in and out of the airport today, because what's interesting, the pattern already shows that it's a more predictable, narrow path, as you would expect, as someone is arriving into the airport. Mm-hmm. But on departures, it's an interesting array of options, and we've separating out the helicopters from the fixed wing, I guess you could say, because I think we always talk about flight paths, and I hear comments about what the flight path may or may not be for one group of planes, but what we're now doing is looking at, because there's been a change out there as far as the users, mm-hmm, and who's not there anymore and who is there and who's generating the traffic. So we are, our GIS staff has been working with the tower in Phoenix. That's where all the information is kept. And we are, I saw some very preliminary, it was only a few day or a week or so of information, but I think we're trying to get like 30 days or something like that information, because I think that will be revealing as far as where are the paths the predominant paths of the flights coming out of the airport, and making sure that, as the mayor, you're suggesting, we wouldn't put anything, we wouldn't want to interfere with that. One of the things we're also doing is not only looking at the path, the flight path itself, but where is the height of the plane at the different intervals on its departure out of the airport. And comparing that, for example, to, you know, other airports where you see arrivals. I would suggest, you know, we talked about this before, maybe one of the things we could do too is, because we've done this a little bit, where we've taken some of what we kind of consider our peer aspiring airports that want to be, you know, the airports in the John Wayne's and some of the others. And it would be interesting. Those are very active airports with a tremendous amount of activity that we would love to have someday. And it would be interesting to kind of lay down the uses around that airport as it compared to here. Because we always, you know, and Mayor, you're absolutely right, the sensitivity. We do not want to do anything that puts a stranglehold on the airport. But I think it's interesting. I think it would be interesting to note what other airports look like and the uses around there, too, and how that compares with this. One of the things I want to remind the council that we're trying to be very careful with, as I've tried to talk with the consultants, is I really don't believe that we're trying to pick one plan. I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I mean, this area is just so large. I think we're trying to give kind of the scenarios of possible development, and I think over time what we're probably going to see is somewhere some mix of all of these. But I think it's important to understand, maybe as we plan out and through John's efforts in the future and with our property owners, where is it we're trying to work towards in the ultimate end. But I'm not sure that we at the end of the day, we're all going to be able to say it's, well, it's only going to be A, and that's all it's going to be. I'm not sure we're that good with our crystal ball, but we are trying to separate and look at the impact of jobs and residential development. One of the things we don't cover here that maybe we can do in another presentation is we talk about the number of jobs and we talk about the job types, and I think that alludes to also the value of jobs. You know, industrial jobs on their ratio per square foot or however we manage it is a very low density, lower paying job than a commercial or office space, higher density, high paying job. So those are some things we need to consider also as we look at these different plans.
Yeah, and I appreciate you being aware of the difference between a noise contour that averages something that shakes you out of bed and something that you can hardly hear, because you get the one at 4 in the morning that's a cargo plane that wakes everybody up, and I don't care what the noise contour level is at that particular overflight, it's that one overflight that, in my opinion, gives the most of the problem. And if we're going to have a right-hand turning pattern to depart because it conflicts with Sky Harbor's arrivals and departures, which I think it's going to have to be, and the technology for establishing waypoints, and I think the waypoint for the turn is probably going to be out in Pinal County, and I think they've done some of that work, then we're still going to be turning along that power line for the long term. And I'm not sure that half mile or whatever that's depicted on this is a wide enough corridor for those departures. And I understand that some of them can get up and out faster if you're empty or don't have a full cargo load, and others are going to take some more time, and they'll never make that. They're going to go quite a bit closer to US 60, and we will have some overflights. But the noise contours and the lines on here are basically on, you know, they have to fly that way if they're going to do a full ILS departure, but, you know, we don't have that type of weather conditions here, but maybe 20 days a year. Usually it's a visual, and they can get out and fly over to a waypoint, and that's why the turning patterns are a little bit different. They can turn in different radiuses to get to waypoints. So I would just say, and I kind of agree with Councilmember Jones here, we established that freeway because that's a right-hand arrival down off from the south, and if you fly a little bit further over, you can actually pick up your glide slope on your ILS. But for the departures, it's going to be a much wider path across there. So when we started narrowing it on, especially on like plan A, and putting more residential out there, and even some of B, I got real concerned that that's why my question is, if you kill the airport, does your plan still survive without that component? if somebody could say, yeah, it's going to be a great urban center with or without an airport, then I'd feel a little more comfortable, but I don't believe that personally. So if I think that the airport is one of the integral mixes to make this successful, then I would rather err on the side of caution on protecting the airport than I would say I made a mistake and now we have to close it or cut back on its performance over a long period of time. We never reach its potential. And if we're going to go global economy and have just-in-time deliveries and the type of employers that we want out there, I think the airport is integrally linked to that. And I don't want to do anything that harms it. And I think some of the residential that's kind of depicted on some of these, in my opinion, even though it's out of the noise contour, could have detrimental effects of that airport. So those would be my comments here this morning. Anyone else on? All right. Is that you? So we'll see. When is the, why don't you give the dates again on the public meetings and input? Is that on a slide?
December 13th and 14th.
All right.
We'll be back here in council.
Okay. We'll see you then.
Great. Thank you.
Item number three is hear a presentation and discuss the West Main Street area plan.
Thank you with us? Yeah.
Wahib. Good morning, Mayor and the council members. This morning we are here to update on the West Main area plan. On November 1st, we updated the council on the plan, and this is just to remind everybody the boundary of the West Main area plan. Since then, what happened is we went to Planning and Zoning Board and Downtown Development Committee and received their recommendations for approval of the plan. The votes were 6-0 for both the boards. When in November 1st we updated the council, there were a lot of discussions, but specifically there were three items that we felt like we'd like to address this morning. Those three are building height, land assembly, and transit station location. Building height, the plan proposes establishing minimum building height, as we discussed earlier, but they were three-story and two-story, three-story around the station, two-story around the corridor. But we have the options of variations of that with council use permit. So yes, the plan proposes for minimum building height, but it says the variations will be accepted through the council use permit. So if someone comes with a two-story for a minimum of three-story, we'll evaluate it and maybe council permit will approve it. So there is that option, so it's not saying you have to be that. But anyway, just to let everybody know, those minimum heights came from the community ideas because community supports it. At the same time, also for TOD kind of development, you need that intensity around the station and the corridor. Otherwise, you're losing the TOD opportunity. Planning and Zoning Board and DDC discussed specifically those two items, minimum building heights, and they support the idea. And also, we think that minimum height with the council use permit option makes the development pattern much easier. So when a developer comes in, wants to build, because right now, if someone wants to build anything above two-story, has to go through different additional process and steps. But with this plan, this allows them to build more than our current standard without going through additional steps. The land assembly was another topic that we discussed. The plan identified that land assembly as basically it is a tool for redevelopment and it's almost a critical tool for redevelopment, but our intention as a staff, we said that we like to encourage property owners during the pre-submittal to say how about doing land assembly, because that allows them to get more advantage of those properties, because we are talking about very few properties, and we are talking about only in the areas that they are so small, especially frontage on the street is development standard, engineering standard, and all kind of things does not make those property viable for redevelopment. So that was, and staff obviously will work as an advisor only. So we are not going and initiating any land assembly. Transit station location was another item that we discussed. Sycamore and Main, we are all aware that the light rail is coming there. But the other two stations are the one that proposed. It's not yet finalized. The future of those will be finalized. And at this point, I think Mike James would be a good one to address those specific questions about transit station locations.
Thank you, Waheed. One of the things that we're looking at in the high-capacity transit study that we're doing on Main Street is, as you know, the alignment, the technology, and ultimately where station locations will be, will we have additional park and rides, all those types of things that go along with high-capacity transit. I think the most important reason why we've, in this early stage, identified stations at the major arterial streets of Country Club and Alma School is that makes that, whether it's light rail or bus rapid transit, you make that connection with the north-south bus. So those north-south bus riders can get off their bus and get on the high capacity system to access the region. That's that's the primary reason I would say that we located those stations at those mile arterial roads. Additionally, and the land use on our proposed area plan reflects this, is there's a real development benefit around those stations. And looking at studies in North Dallas University has done, as well as some studies in the Portland area around their light rail that's been in place for many years, there's a real direct benefit of land uses and development within a quarter mile of those stations. And those benefits are primarily with the retail, commercial, office, and residential. Residential is interesting because in the studies that have been done, that the development benefit, you know, the higher property values, higher lease rates for residential go out even a half mile from those stations. So that's really kind of the development or redevelopment benefit that we see of having these stations at these arterial mile locations. From an operation perspective, working closely with Metro last several years, there is going to be a predictive priority signal system in the roadway for the rail system. What that does, using GIS and sophisticated computer systems, it will sense the speed of the train and where it is, and if it can allow an additional 6 seconds of green time for that light, it will do so. But not every train is going to get that green light. Some of those trains are going to have to stop at those signalized intersections. As such, if you've got a station at these locations, each vehicle has four doors. The passengers can load and unload very quickly off these stations. They've prepaid. There's four doors per vehicle. So the loading is actually very quick. Just for reference, I don't know, you know, what the community perception is, but the actual travel time that the Metro is predicting from the Sycamore station to downtown Phoenix is 33 minutes. So while there are a lot of signalized intersections, the predictive priority works pretty well, and we think that's a pretty good time to be expecting on that system. So that's a little bit of the background on why we have those station locations in the plan at this time. They could change. We're going through the high capacity transit study. There may be environmental or other reasons why these might not work, and we'll flush through that as well. But we think these are solid locations, and that's how we've moved forward with the plan.
With this plan, these are the action items we have identified. Basically, that we, after this plan adoptions, we have to go and change the general plan or amend the general plan, because current general plan does not take care of the TOD in that land use category. And our purpose of doing that, obviously, is to make that area redeveloped much easier, more flexible, more expedited way. Those are the main intentions. So when someone comes and wants to redevelop it, they don't have to go through amending the general plan. So at least we can take that step out and if it accepts with the plans, so we are exploring more expedited way of reviewing also. And we obviously we're working on developing a TOD ordinance because that will take care of a lot of the details for the plan ordinance. And then, of course, we have to plan for the capital improvement. And in our last update also, we kind of said that the community wants to create a board or a committee to act like a keeper of their vision for this plan. And, of course, we have to do that later on talking with the city and the community. And the other item is, of course, encourage public-private partnerships. That concludes my presentation. If you have any questions, we'll be happy to answer. Thank you.
Let me ask a question on your station locations. There are several car dealerships and others that are deciding to move out to the freeway as opposed to along the Main Street corridor. So there may be some large tracts of land that would be on the market for a station location. Why couldn't you swing the bus line for a quarter mile or an eighth of a mile off from your major arterial to hit one of the stations? Why does it have to be at the intersection of Country Club and Alma School? Couldn't it be offset back in and just swing the bus line?
Yes, Mayor, it could. One of the things that we do try to do in transit planning is eliminate that out of direction travel. We know in some cases you absolutely have to do that. In fact, when we open our line in about a year, the Alma School route, we'll come up Alma School, turn left, you know, and go over to the Sycamore Station. It will deviate so that those people on Alma School can get to the transit center. But yes, you can do that.
Okay.
And that this plan does not preclude doing that.
I just see some little circles on your map here, and it looks like at Alma School you're taking out the corner there by the, you know, it's all developed. It seems to me that there are some areas in there that make more sense, especially if you want to redevelop it around it in a more high-intensity manner, that I certainly wouldn't limit myself to those locations for stations. The other one is I really don't like the number of station stops that there are from downtown Mesa to the other side of the line or downtown Phoenix when you have some of the other places that I've ridden and you've got one every half a mile or mile. Just seems to me like there's too many station stops to get any speed out of it. So I understand what you're saying about the speed, and you're right, you can board and unboard very quickly, but I would rather have fewer stops than make it so that nobody wants to ride it because it's too slow. So that speed aspect is critical for me to make sure that people still want to use it as opposed to hopping in a car. So it shouldn't take any longer to do it on a light rail. In fact, the light rail should be faster getting from one side to the other. And I know in peak periods it is, but I want it faster all the time, even through the day. You shouldn't be able to beat it over there in a car. So that would be a consideration for me. And if we are at some point going to embrace this technology, if it does actually work, and we end up going clear out to Gateway or someplace else to tie into the airport, it's going to be 2 hours or something to get from one side of town to the other. That's too long. So maybe we need to look at now having a better spacing or develop an express light rail line or, you know, have some turnouts so the faster one can go through or something else needs to be thought of, I think, of today in order to make sure that it also accomplishes the speed that we want. So those would be my comments. Tom?
Two areas. One on the transit and discussing future stations down the line. Maybe we need to have, and I'm just suggesting this, but I can remember during the election in Prop 400 where we were talking about light rail and there was going to be a five-year study period, but then there was going to be an evaluation before there was expansion. And if there was expansion, then there was going to be certain money available to us for certain things. And I'd like to have kind of an update on that. I can't remember it all right now. But I think, and I know there's an alignment study that's going on that sort of says, if all of this happens in 2013, this is what we're going to do. And we do have to plan ahead, and I understand that. But I'd kind of like to have maybe a brief study session topic on what is the status of light rail, how's it work from here going forward. And because I think we're making a lot of decisions. Because, I mean, I agree with the mayor. I mean, if you've got a high transit corridor that doesn't have light rail down Main Street east of Sycamore, then you certainly don't need these high capacity transit stations. You know, if it's just a bus line, you don't need a station. You need a bus stop. So I'd just like to get a feel for where we are with that. And secondly, on the I go back to the height issue. We're basically telling people that you have to build this high unless you get our permission to do something else. And I find that unacceptable.
I would like to comment on the first point you were making, Council Member Rawls. The density on the station area along Country Club and Elma School is around 17 dwelling units per acre. And studies in other areas like CDOT, California, DOT, and others have shown that even with Premier Express bus service, which has plans for considering BRT as a premier bus service, the dwelling units, the density is around 15 to 17. So even if like we are saying, we are still discussing the plans for stations for light rail, but considering that express bus service would come along the main street, such density should be able to cater to the express bus service. So irrespective of the fact that what kind of service we have in the future, the density we have chosen in this plan would be sufficient to cater to such service and would be able to bring such development.
Right, and I was actually using the discussion that we're having on this plan to springboard into something else that I'd just like to have an update on. But I do think that the type of station and et cetera would be different with a light rail, with a train, than it would be with a bus. So I was really using this as a springboard, so thank you.
Maybe I could add a point. One of the things in response to what Councilman Rawls is talking about, RPTA did put together service efficiency and effectiveness measures that they're going to start implementing to get to that, I guess they call before and after review. And actually, they've been very helpful to me in going through Mesa Stat. So those things are in place, and we can bring that back. So
all I'm asking for is you know, there are certain things built into the Prop 400 that was part of the vote, and we're now sort of planning for an affirmative finding, and I just want to know.
I can answer some of that right now so that everybody can hear it. There was a full funding grant agreement based on 26,000 boardings per day for one. The other one is it was going to open in 2008, and we funded it for high capacity transit. We're one of the few that didn't say it's going to be a light rail line, and that's what we're going for. But at high capacity transit, we did it with the anticipation of putting in enough money that it would accommodate light rail under that dollar set aside for Prop 400. And that's, you know, I was the one that worked on the funding formulas and who got what, and did fund it for a high capacity that would allow the building of light rail. You wouldn't have to, because you'd have plenty for the bus aspect of it. But then even the bus could be a dedicated lane, which comes closer to the light rail aspect.
And I appreciate that. Maybe you and I can have a conversation sometime. But I do. When I read the newspapers, I keep seeing stories about where's the next legs, the next links of light rail going. That sort of assumes and presumes that there is going to be an extension of light rail, which is dependent upon the performance that's supposed to be evaluated, and that part never gets into the stories. Yeah. And so I'm just trying to make sure that people don't think that we have committed to building extensions of light rail until we get this five-year report in 2013, right?
Actually, I think there's a report that comes out in 2010, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, my understanding was it was a five-year trial period, but it could have been two.
Yeah. Well, we're going to know real quickly because
it's going to have a rush of ridership in the beginning, and then the test is going to be how it does over long periods.
Okay. All right. Vice Mayor.
I want to go back to a question that Tom asked you, and then Waheed, your response to that question. Tom said to you, and you can tell me this isn't exactly what you said, but he said, if you want to build something other than two or three story, you're going to have to come and ask our permission. And you said, yes, that's true. Now, my understanding is that, no, that isn't true, that if you want to build under the existing zoning, not go with the TOD, you can build under your existing zoning category. That was one of the things that we were putting in here, was the either-or zoning.
You're absolutely right. Sorry. if you're building today, you'll go with your current zoning standard. When the TOD ordinance will be developed, we don't have a TOD ordinance yet in the book. The idea is at that time, a property owner can come and request for it. So if they request, then only these things will be implemented. Otherwise, I mean, if you have a C2 today, you want to build it there as a C2, there is no way we can say, like, you cannot build it, like, under C2. Because I don't have, frankly speaking, I don't have a TOD ordinance in the book to suggest. All we can suggest, encourage, do everything. But so until that is done, we cannot do
it. So we're not taking existing zoning away. We are giving them an additional option to use TOD in this area. I want to make sure that that's really clear, because that's a totally different concept than saying to somebody, you must use TOD in this area.
Yeah. Daryl.
I'm continually confused because I carefully listened to the phrasing that Waheed was using. You keep saying, well, I don't have a TOD ordinance today. The question, I think, is when you have a TOD ordinance, will they then be asked to follow the TOD ordinance, or will they still be able to do it under the conventional methodologies?
We are not going to go as a city and rezone somebody else's property. That's one thing clear we've been telling the community, and everybody knows. So the whole idea is, if your property is next to the station, with all this planning process, we were able to educate and everybody understand that your property is much worthwhile and take advantage of TOD than, let's say, M1 or C2 today. So the whole idea is then you will come to the city and request for a rezone and say, I want to rezone my property from C2 to, let's say, TMX1, mixed-use TOD ordinance. So it is not a forceful rezoning. It is, you will ask for it.
I guess my question, though, is it just zoning ordinances? This is general plans and all kinds of things. We're going to adopt this. We're basically going to amend the general plan. So I think you've answered the question. I just want to be very clear that someone who wishes to develop and has some commercial zoning doesn't get stipulated by this new general plan to do things that they aren't not stipulated to do today unless they choose to change their zoning.
Right.
Mayor, Vice Mayor, and Council Members, let me try my hand at this and see if hopefully I'll help clear it up and not muddy it, but we'll see where it goes. Correct. Adoption of the plan set some policy direction by council for what we would like to see there, the type of development we will in the future be trying to encourage, but adoption of a plan does not stipulate anybody's property, does not change anybody's zoning. So until we do something that changes the actual rules on the ground through the zoning, people can continue to do what the current zoning allows. We will look at that and give some evaluation, some feedback based on where we would like to go. But it has no real force until there's the zoning regulations that apply. Then, as we've just been talking about, the current zoning on the property will continue to exist until a new zoning ordinance is adopted and then applied to individual pieces of property. The current zoning today establishes basically a maximum height of 2 stories, and to do anything more than that, you have to get special approval to go higher through a BIZ. What we've said all along with this plan is we want to identify the type of development we would like to see in these areas, then we want to make that to be the easiest and simplest thing to do. We won't prohibit other things necessarily, but it may then become the things that require the extra hoop or the extra approval. So what we're considering at this point, and also seeing as the very first preliminary draft of a potential TOD ordinance, and it's looking at what is currently in the plan document and is suggesting then that in those zones that somebody could choose to apply to the property, it would allow you by right to build between that 2 and 5 or 3 and 6 stories. But if you want to go more or less, then that's what would then maybe require the special approval.
Okay. Vice Mayor.
Okay. But once again, if somebody has current C2 zoning, they want to build C2 right there on Main Street at a single level height, we will help them to get that through. It's currently allowed with their zoning. Putting this a change in the general plan does not make it so that they can't. What it does is, it says if they come in and they say, I have C2 zoning, but what I'd really like to do here is, now with the new light rail station there, I'd like to have a mixed development. I'd like to have retail on the ground floor. I'd like to have some office up above it. I'd like to have a higher density, and I'd like to go to two stories or three stories potentially. Then we say, great, then use the then come back in, and we have this transit-oriented development thing that's already in place for you to just lay on top of there. You don't have to go out, fight with Board of Adjustments, do this, do this, do this. But if they don't want to do that, if they just want to deal with their current zoning that they have today, they can keep their zoning. The city isn't going to force them to change it. The city isn't even going to go out there and say, you know, if you don't, we're going to make your life miserable. None of that stuff is happening. I want to make that really clear. Did I lay out all the stuff we were talking about there, Daryl, Tom, what you were worried about? Did I lay out all the nasty stuff?
Tom, let me try to ask a very specific question so I can understand how it works specifically. Let's say that the person owns property immediately to the east of the Sycamore Transit Station. That piece of property right now is zoned, I don't care what it's zoned, but it's zoned C2, okay? And he can build under that zoning anywhere up to two stories. Under the plan, that area is then going to be an area that should be three stories minimum, right? Okay. Can he come in and say, I'm going to build a one-story building there and not get any kind of difficulty from the city?
Yeah. Correct.
Okay. So nothing changes for him.
Mayor and Councilman Rawls, but I would suggest, I know that sounds real simple, but I am sure that there will be a staff report that will say,
right,
this is not consistent
with the plan.
POD. With the plan. Absolutely. But it will still be allowed to go through. We will work it through, and we will not hold it up because it is as of right. But there will be a recommend. There's no doubt because the purpose of this plan, let's make this very clear, this has been worked out with the property owners in the neighborhoods because this is what we, this is the vision of what we want. Okay, but we are not going to come in and rezone their property and take away their current development rights. But certainly, there's no doubt about it. Just like the Southeast plan we just talked about, this is what we do. We tell the community and the property owners, this is the vision we as a community have for this property, and we think this is probably the best maximum use for this property because it's going to be a node, a transportation node. Does that prohibit them from developing it under their current zoning, and would we prohibit that? No.
Would there be a staff recommendation?
There will be a staff recommendation. Would have to say. We wouldn't go through all this work and not be genuine, and I suspect that's why you see in here a recommendation that the neighborhoods want to have this board or committee, because they want some oversight for them to be able to weigh in and say, hey, we don't think this development is consistent with all the work we put in to making this work. Now, is that going to stop someone from being able to move forward as of right? No, but it would create at least a discussion that this doesn't seem to fit with the overall vision and goals that have been laid out under the plan.
Let me follow up if I can, Mayor. The person has the C2 zoning now. He comes in. What does he need in order to build his building? He doesn't need council approval. He needs site plan approval.
That's correct. And even in this location, we'd have to check. It may be on stipulated zoning because it may have been there long enough before there's any stipulation even for a site plan.
If a person comes in with a site plan that is not consistent with the West Main Street area plan, is staff going to approve it?
Mayor, Councilman Rawls, if they don't even need a site plan, if they're meeting the ordinances, yes, we will approve it. We'll process it, and we will approve it.
If for a one-story building that's inconsistent with the plan, site plan review or whatever, that will be approved even though it's inconsistent with the plan.
We would do that. We would, again, as city managers pointed out, even if it's just a staff review, we will look at the plan, we'll look at the design, we will suggest things that can maybe make it more pedestrian-oriented, create some of the plazas, some of those things, but there, if it's meeting the ordinances, we'll have to approve it.
Meeting the ordinances that existed before the adoption of this plan and before the TOD ordinance?
Right. We'll have to meet the ordinances that apply to the property.
Right now, assuming they don't have some sort of grandfathered right, that site plan approval goes through the Planning and Zoning Commission. Mm-hmm. And if it gets delegated to the West Main Street Committee, then it's up to them to approve it. No. Unless they can appeal it to the council.
We don't have a legal right to turn down.
Mayor.
You need to ask Senator.
Councilman, let me.
You can turn down side lights. Well, I've done it.
I guess two things there maybe need to be discussed. One is the role of this committee that's being anticipated. It's really not any different than the Citrus Area Homeowners Association or the Lehigh area group, and we anticipate it being something that we would send the applicant to as part of the citizen participation process to review and help provide some feedback. It's not a formal board that can ever make any decisions or anything like that. That's not what's
more
what's
like
anticipated.
The downtown economic development
it's
board
not that,
or something.
It's not that much of a board. They just want to make sure there's a recognized group, whether it's just something they form themselves or ultimately something that's recognized by the city. There is some group there that we can feed information to and provide some feedback to us as a part of that review process. And then I think the other part was in terms of the site plan. If they've got the zoning, denying the site plan becomes difficult. Massaging it, working around to make sure it meets the codes, we can do, but denying it gets difficult. Ultimately, if they've got the zoning, it meets the zoning.
I understand. Denying it for those reasons.
Okay. We've actually had some cases come up, and the Citrus area is one that I remember very closely, and the neighbors come in and indicate, well, we're trying to protect the citrus and have a certain setback, and this person certainly has the right to build this according to zoning, but we're the neighborhood, and we say that he ought to do it differently. So that's their input, and so there's some political pressure saying, hey, you told us to go for him and tell us what we wanted, we did, and now you're not going by it because you believe that the person's individual property rights supersede our rights as a neighborhood to tell that guy what to do? Yes. Your property rights do supersede. And so he can do what he wants with his property is what this council has done on several occasions. Now, that doesn't mean that the next council will bow to the pressure of a citizen group as opposed to a private property owner. And I think that's the fundamental discussion we're kind of getting to here this morning. Vice Mayor.
But, Mayor, there's a legal point here, too, and that is that if somebody has zoning, in some of the cases that we have encountered, their zoning did not exist for what the person was coming in and requesting. But if somebody has existing zoning, and on all of these properties, I can't think of one that does not have existing zoning. If they have existing zoning and they bring in a site plan, there are only a handful of reasons that we can deny them. I mean, we can't go deny, deny, deny. They just take us to court and say, what you're really trying to do is you're trying to let us not use our zoning. And Ms. Spinner, if I'm wrong about that, please correct me.
Mayor and Vice Mayor, you're correct. I think this is going to be a gray area that we're going to have to work through. They do have existing zoning. We cannot prevent them from building what they're entitled to build under that zoning. Otherwise, we'd have Prop 207 issues. We would obviously have taking issues. Site plan review is not a legislative decision. It's an administrative decision, so there's less discretion in approving or not approving a site plan review. Our code does provide some guidance in terms of what's to be considered when approving or considering a site plan, and those will have to be followed. But simply adopting the TOD ordinance, if and when council does, that's not going to change people's zoning. So they will still have the right to build whatever they currently have zoned.
And in fact, there have been times when I have wanted to deny a site plan, and I have been told that legally I can't vote no on whatever it is. And so I'm saying, why are you even asking me to vote if you're telling me I can't vote? And you're saying, because the law requires you to vote. So.
Okay. Tom?
There's no question there. I'm not sure that we're not mixing two things, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. Zoning deals with the use of the land, correct? How you can use it, whether it's C2 or residential or industrial. That doesn't deal with height.
It
doesn't. Does it? Yeah. The zoning does? The
ordinance
does.
Yes.
Intensity.
Setbacks and heights.
Yeah, I know that. I know that. But those are all maximum. We're not talking about imposing minimums.
Yes.
Mayor, Councilmember Rawls, in this area, the TOD ordinance may talk about minimums. Typically, we talk about, we might want to establish build two lines in this area. Instead of saying you can be set back this far or further, we may be trying to encourage people to build to the street and bring them the other way, for example, as well as the height issue.
All right, I see what you said. Thank you.
All right.
Mayor, before we close, let me mention something you brought in the
in the agenda, the language on the agenda in item number 3.1b, we're going to modify the last sentence. The sentence should be taken out, as you mentioned.
I agree.
And the attachment number one is the actual resolution on the, okay, the staff report.
All right, just make the correction before Monday.
All right.
Thanks. Daryl.
So the one thing I just wanted to add was that we keep thinking that somebody has this option to use their existing zoning, and they do, or come forward. And I just want to foresee what I think are some of the variants of that. And I think that you're going to see people that may come forward and ask to use the TOD ordinance that don't want to do two-story minimum or three-story minimum, but there are other features of that ordinance that are desirable to them. And so I just see that coming, mm-hmm, and happening, that they will come and say, I like this part of that ordinance, I don't like this part, and so we're going to get these use permit requests that says, let me do this part, but don't do that part.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Right. And the solution to that is either take one or the other? Is it?
Do you think
you can do a blending?
As long as you've got the use permit part, I guess we've got lots of flexibility here.
Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you very much. Item number four is hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on the 2008 state legislative agenda. And I'm going to go. I have a meeting over in Phoenix that I need to attend, so I'm going to excuse myself and turn this over to the Vice Mayor.
Thank you, Mayor. Morning, Scott.
Good morning, Mayor, Vice Mayor. Sorry, Mayor, this wasn't as exciting as land use, so he's going to an MWA meeting right now, which would be a lot of fun. Vice Mayor, Council, we did want to bring forward this morning our 2008 state legislative agenda for your consideration and review. What we'd like to do is just briefly go through the PowerPoint that's on the screen, should be at your desk right now. Some of you on the Intergovernmental Affairs Committee, this will be a bit of a repeat, so we'll try to just move through it quickly and just leave more time for question and discussion. Just as a reminder, the legislative session does convene on Monday, January 14th. This will be Governor Napolitano's sixth State of the State address, and we still have a relatively small separation in majority and minority parties in the legislature, which always makes for an interesting mix as legislation moves forward. It remains the same as last year. In the Senate, 17 to 13 Republican majority, and in the House, a 33 to 27 Republican majority. There's a few major themes this year. One I know you're all familiar with, and we're going to talk a little bit more as we talk specifically about legislative initiatives, but the first is the state budget deficit that's developing and really changing daily. We did update this from the last week to reflect more of what JLBC and the state legislators are reporting right now is a projected budget deficit of somewhere between $800 million and $1 billion at the state legislature. And so obviously that's going to have a tremendous impact on funding priorities, legislation moving forward, and also shared revenue between cities and the state. It goes without saying that election year politics will also come into play. Not only do we normally see a large increase in the number of bills introduced during election years as candidates and elected officials try to get their issues out on the table for discussion at the legislature, but also we have numerous candidates, state legislators, who are looking to run for different political offices, some at the state level, corporation commission, and others, and then some who have formed exploratory committees to look at congressional opportunities as well. So that will come into play. And again, we mentioned on the previous slide the close partisan divide that still is pervasive at the legislature. Wanted to quickly turn it over to Brent Stoddard to run through just very quickly our legislative guiding principles. And what we decided to do this year, we're not changing anything than what we've done in years past, but we wanted to try to put on paper some of the guiding principles that we use because things are so fluid at the legislature and we see a lot of changes day in and day out. We work very closely with the mayor and shaping our day-to-day, hour-to-hour agenda, and then bring that back to council for your input that we can always discuss at study sessions throughout the year. But these are kind of what guide us as we go about our daily business down at the legislature. So, Brent, if you don't mind running through that.
Sure. Vice Mayor, Council, as Scott mentioned, the state shared revenue discussion is going to be a big item at the legislature. So the first guiding principle would be fiscal sustainability. The city would have prioritize the preservation of state shared revenue, including the transaction privilege tax, which is our sales tax. We receive a 25% distribution base of that. In addition, the urban revenue sharing, we receive 15% of the income tax that the state collects as part of the state shared revenue agreement. We would oppose any type of reductions or caps in those distributions to the cities. Also, we would support the full funding of existing revenue streams that we rely on. You're familiar with the Heritage Funds, the HERF Highway User Revenue Funds, the Vehicle Licensing Tax, Local Transportation Assistance Funds, and oppose any attempts to redirect any funds to the general fund to help the budget problem. We're beginning to see some of those suggestions already come out in the budget to divert funds from the revenue streams that we currently rely on.
You know, now might be a good time to talk about, because you're talking about state shared revenue, about how state shared revenue works and how we get, you know, what, how that's based, how much money we get is based.
Absolutely, Vice Mayor, and Brent can certainly explain that. I will just add, though, tomorrow you serve on the League Executive Committee, and you'll be hearing a presentation, and so I think this may be the last time we use the term state shared revenue, because in the future, what we would like to relate to the public and relate to the legislatures is that this is city shared revenue. The cities actually produce this revenue through our hard work at economic development and job creation at the local level, and we entered into a revenue sharing agreement thanks to the voters in the 70s when they approved the way that we currently share revenue between cities and the state, a mechanism that streamlines tax collection so that we don't have local income tax, that we don't have local luxury taxes, and that's being all collected by the Department of Revenue and then returned, a portion of which, 15%, returned back to cities and towns. We think, based on the reports out of the University of Arizona report that the League has commissioned, showing that 92% of economic activity is derived in incorporated areas in this state, that 15% is a pretty good deal for the state, that's all they have to return to us because of the hard work that we do in creating livable, sustainable communities that are attractive to employers as they locate places. And so, Brent, did you want to talk a little bit about the 15% specifics?
Sure. As Scott had mentioned, so we had the 1972 initiative, which allowed a sharing of revenue with the city. Essentially what happens is the state collects the revenue, and 2 years later, cities and towns receive their distribution. So there is a two-year lag. So the urban revenue sharing fund that we're talking about in this budget is actual revenue that the taxpayers paid two fiscal years ago. And in the 2006 legislative session, the legislature provided, when they did their income tax cuts, they provided a one-time pre-appropriation of $727 million to the Urban Revenue Sharing Fund for cities. Now, the $727 was provided as a hold harmless for cities and towns against those income tax for 1 year. $717 million of that was what the amount would be if the income tax it wouldn't have happened. And then the additional $10 million on top of the $717 was to bring cities whole from percent reductions that had happened in the past. In fact, from fiscal years 93 to 97, cities and towns' 15% income tax percent sharing had been reduced to 12.8%. And during the 2003-2004 fiscal years, it was also reduced. So there's been a significant period of time within the last decade that cities and towns have shared in some of the pain that the state has shared through some of the budget crises.
But Brent, the city always shares in the pain.
Correct.
Because and let's talk about that for a second, because some legislators have been inclined to say, well, the cities should share in the pain. we always share in the pain, because if you're getting a percentage of a pie and the size of the pie is reduced, the amount of money goes down. Then if you get hit with a reduction in the percentage, you get double hit. Plus, you understand that what's happening at the local level is we are also taking in less money in sales tax. And so we get that triple hit. So this notion that somehow the cities don't share in the pain is just a false notion.
Correct. And that's and you're right. You're exactly right. So we are getting double hit, and that's one of the arguments that we made to the legislature, and that's one of the reasons that they provided for this one-time hold harmless. Unfortunately, with the budget cuts as they are coming to the state, they're now talking about removing the $10 million on top of the $727 million, in addition to talking about further reducing state shared revenue. So in the past, we've had the double hits, and unfortunately, we're coming into a period of time now where we're also facing the potential of getting that double type of hit. And that's one of the reasons we have the fiscal sustainability as one of the top priorities guiding our legislative efforts this year at the state legislature.
Yeah, and Vice Mayor, maybe to just add to that as well, one of the things, we're lucky. We have a lot of Mesa and East Valley legislators that really get this, that understand the role that shared revenue plays in our cities and towns. But unfortunately, we have some legislators that are frustrated by that agreement. And when you do have a large portion of money that is separated out on a budget line item, it's an easy target. It's a sitting duck in a year when you're having tough budget times. But we have to remember and go back to the two-year lag time. When this money that we will be collecting this year was collected by the state had over $1 billion budget surplus. So when times were great for the state, it's finally coming to us in the form of what the voters had said through their 15% this year. And so it's not that in the times when the states are tough, the cities are flush in revenue. That's hardly it. It's the two-year lag time that really comes into play. So we're seeing an increase in our allocation, but that really coincides with the budget surplus that the state received, that state had 2 years ago. So that's also an important detail to keep in mind.
And state shared revenue is distributed based on percentage of population of incorporated municipalities. So I think that Mesa is roughly around 9.5% of the distribution that's provided for state shared revenue. So when we're talking in $10 million, $17 million cuts, we're talking about a significant amount of money that has an impact on the city budget.
Yeah. Councilmember Ralston, Councilmember Jones.
Just a quick question. What is the amount of the state budget? How big is it?
There's two different numbers. Vice Mayor, Councilmember Ross, there's two different numbers that are played with. One is the budget number that we hear annually as we talk about the legislature, which is about $10 billion, dollars, give or take. The larger number, though, that's obligated through federal disbursements that are untouchable, undiscretionary, somewhere around $25 billion, I believe, is the larger number. That's the number you hear less.
So it's essentially a $10 billion discretionary budget. Is that an easier way to
give or take? I'm sure there are many, Vice Mayor and Councilmember Rawls, I'm sure there's many legislators who would say out of that $10 billion, a lot is non-discretionary, but that's really the number that they have the luxury to move things around in.
So they're looking at up perhaps as much as a 10% hit on their budget, on their discretionary budget. I mean, if it's $1 billion shortfall, then they have to figure out a way to cut 10% of their budget.
Correct. So,
Councilmember Jones.
Okay, back on the revenue sharing agreement back in 72, wasn't that, I mean, historically it's been 15%. Was it a fixed number when it was approved? And what I'm driving at is those who are pushing to reduce it, do they want to just throw out that and go back to the arguments before that agreement came into being, which was a big nightmare?
Vice Mayor and Councilmember Jones, the answer is yes, it was a fixed amount, 15%. At that time, though, obviously in 72, that was prior to the Voter Protection Act, and so it gives the discretion to the legislature then to move that 15% around. And there have been times, there have been past administrations, past governors as well, who have, in the time where we have seen a decrease in that number, have also, not as often as we've seen a decrease, but we've seen some increases too. So there's been an understanding on the part of some past administrations, and I would say the current administration, that this is a useful tool and really important for our communities. But we do have some members of the legislature, including the, for example, the Senate Appropriations Chairman, who believes that local communities should collect income tax at a local level, so that we should do that, and has stated that publicly quite often. And it's just philosophically his belief that the state should not be collecting something that then derives and benefits the local community, that we should be responsible for that collection. But we believe a single point of collection is better for taxpayers, it's better for communities, and makes the system a lot simpler.
I just don't see how a sane person wants to open up that discussion again, but okay.
Right. Okay. The second guiding principle is local control, and this is really a principle of local self-governance, giving the city the ability to make the decisions at the local level to best meet the needs of the communities. So the city would support the protection of local control and decision-making authority, and specifically oppose any attempts to erode this through any preemptions or mandates that may be placed by the state. Economic development. The city obviously relies on many tools for the economic development that we see in the city, and this guiding principle would simply state that we support efforts to maintain and enhance the economic development mechanisms available to create the future economic development in the city, including increasing tools for private sector revitalization, and we would attempt any attempts at limiting or prohibiting economic development or the tools and mechanisms that would be available. For the neighborhoods, this would focus on preserving and enhancing the quality of life in the communities of the city. We would support the appropriate initiatives to preserve the safety and security of the neighborhoods and the communities within the city. Public safety, we support efforts to maintain and improve the ability for the city to strategically plan for and respond to any emergencies, the public safety needs of the community. For transportation, another big issue at the legislature and in and local communities and throughout the state, the city would support the continual regional transportation planning and funding and the revenue streams that are specifically dedicated to the region, preserving those, and oppose any attempts to restrict or place any type of restrictions or implementation on the funding mechanisms that provide for those transportation projects. And lastly, water is a priority. Support the efforts to ensure the sustainability of water resources in the city, in the region, and sustainable development associated with those water supplies.
And, oh, I'm sorry.
Excuse me, Councilmember Jones.
With that water discussion, we haven't had a great deal of success with AMWA.
Yes.
Maybe push legislatively requirement of recharging back into the aquifers you draw water out of. I'd really like to look at that.
Absolutely, Vice Mayor, Councilmember Jones. In fact, that's where the mayor is right now at an AMWA legislative hearing, and it's been a point of frustration, I know, for the city, in that some of the aquifer issues haven't been addressed legislatively. What the forum the mayor is at right now is discussing, because water is such a difficult issue, and there were so many different communities of interest involved in the discussion, that there was a feeling by some that moving forward with legislation during the 08 cycle would not allow for adequate input from rural Arizona, from some of the larger utilities like SRP and others to really weigh in. So a stakeholders process has been developed through AMWA, where those divergent communities of interest will hopefully come together and try in 09 to move forward with some legislation protecting the aquifers. It's a long road to hoe, but we're now looking at an 09 legislative effort on that issue.
Okay. We just need to stay on top of it.
We've been very fortunate in Mesa to be the recipients of a lot of information from the East Valley Water Forum that have let us know what many people may not be aware of, and that is how important recharging, as Councilmember Jones just talked about, recharging in the appropriate aquifer is. It isn't just a matter of recharging. We all feel good about recharging that we've done for years and years, but it doesn't. If you recharge on the west side, it doesn't help the east side. If you recharge in Tucson, it doesn't help Phoenix. You know, those kinds of things are very important, and so the educational component is moving forward, and the mayor is down to do one of those educational presentations right now. Yes, did you have something? Okay, go ahead.
Vice Mayor, moving forward, just wanted to talk about understanding this year is going to be a difficult year at the legislature with the budget taking the primary focus. We really want to pare down and be realistic in what we might be able to achieve at the legislature this year, understanding the financial constraints that they have, and talk about what we can do to carry Mesa's agenda forward. And obviously one issue that's been of great interest from many levels, from a transportation level, from an economic development level, from an aviation level even, has been the further expansion and possible acceleration of the Gateway Freeway. And we've been working very closely with transportation to talk about funding mechanisms. So we have a lot of discussion that we need to bring back to council in the coming months about how we would do this and the ins and outs of the financing. But one thing that became very obvious from the outset of this discussion is that some of the funding mechanisms in place at the state, grants anticipation notes and some of the other funding mechanisms that we've used in the past to accelerate freeways are all tied up right now. The I-10 advancement in the West Valley that you've heard so much about through the MAG process over the last few months actually ate up a lot of the state's GAN capacity for the next 10 years. And so for Mesa then, it's left us with the choice of How do we then use the financing potentially to do that? And one of the things that we did back in 2001 when we were faced with a similar situation and we're trying to advance the Red Mountain Freeway from Gilbert to from Country Club to Gilbert was we went to the legislature and proactively created HPANs, Highway Project Anticipation Notes, and Jeff Martin and the folks and transportation were very instrumental in getting this legislation drafted and moved through. This created a capacity of up to $100 million that we could bond against. Fortunately, though, back in the distant days of 2001, $100 million could actually buy you something on freeway construction. Unfortunately, now we're seeing cost estimates come in on the Loop 303 in the West Valley that are pegging highway construction somewhere around $75 million a mile. So the rising cost of commodities and construction materials and other ways have really increased the price of construction. So the $100 million threshold won't really buy us that much. And so what we're proposing to do, and we've been working with some outside counsel and with transportation on really figuring out how this would work, is to go back to the HPANs as a mechanism. And what we're proposing is just to simply increase the capacity of those HPAN bonds from $100 million to $300 million. And that would allow us, we think, the capacity to at least do phase one of the Gateway acceleration and possibly leave some additional room in case at some point later we decide to accelerate phase two of the Gateway Freeway. So that's the first and probably the most important Mesa-sponsored legislation that we're proposing, Vice Mayor.
And Councilmember Summers, who chairs the Intergovernmental Affairs Committee, would say this if he were here, so I will throw it in. And he would say, and what is there to not like about that plan?
Yeah.
That's going to be something that the legislators should like.
That's exactly right. We're working with our some members of our delegation right now. Wouldn't want to say their names because we haven't fully briefed them on it, but obviously we think that this is an issue that will be embraced by our East Valley legislators and something that makes a lot of sense that will help in transportation and in economic development. The just moving forward then, we have already touched on the state shared revenue. We won't belabor that point, though it is probably, if any point should be belabored, that may be it. But
Councilmember Ross.
Can I belabor it a little bit more?
Sure.
I'm a little bit confused between something that I've always called state shared revenue and something that you've identified as the Urban Revenue Sharing Fund.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this 727 is from the Urban Revenue Sharing Fund, is it not? That was the one-time hold harmless thing plus the $10 million.
That's correct, Vice Mayor and Councilmember Rawls. That's correct. There are numerous funds, everything from HERF to others that are really constitute the larger pot of shared revenue.
Right, Mike. What of those various items in those or various pots was subject to the voter approval distribution levels in 1972? Was that just the Urban Revenue Sharing Fund?
It was the Urban Revenue Sharing Fund.
So the sales tax, there is no voter-approved percentage distribution for the sales tax revenue sharing fund?
No, there was not a voter-approved initiative for that. There had always been an agreement with the state collecting the sales tax and distributing.
Right, and right. We have the power to impose our own
correct
sales tax. So I guess I view the Urban Revenue Sharing Fund, which was voter approved at a particular percentage, in a slightly different way than I view the rest of the state shared revenue. And I know that it's, you know, because we know we get the double hit, but I have to tell you, asking for the full funding of that is kind of like a child asking the parent to don't cut my allowance even though you lost your job, Dad. You know, even though you have less money coming in, I still want my full allowance.
Go. Percentage.
What?
Percentage.
Yeah,
percentage,
it's a percentage of dad's now bringing in less money.
And I agree. But we talk about in our legislative, one of our guiding principles here, this was the words that troubled me, was full funding of existing revenue source. That seems to suggest we want the same amount. You know, if we're talking about percentage, if we're talking about the pie being smaller and we get the same percentage of the smaller pie, I can accept that, but I don't want us to be perceived as saying we don't have to participate in the belt tightening that is going to have to occur overall. Shouldn't happen on either of them, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
And Vice Mayor, Councilmember Rawls, I totally understand what you're saying, and I guess what we really mean by that is understanding that there may be cuts on some different funds along the way. We would not like to see the state to leverage its financial problems strictly on the backs of cities and towns. And there are other funds like DPS has been paid out of HERF for many years, and we've made tremendous progress over the last several years of diverting that back to away from a highway maintenance and a street maintenance effort to saying the state needs to find another source to pay for DPS.
And I agree. I think it's going to need to be a question of how we approach.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need to understand that we're going to get less money because there is less money. We just don't want you to take more than what we have previously agreed to.
Yeah, and Vice Mayor, Councilman, I think we actually were agreeing with you.
Mm-hmm.
I think the issue becomes a timing issue is that because of the two-year delay,
right?
The state, as I understand, has already benefited from those income taxes that came in 2 years ago.
Right.
We're just now seeing that potentially come to us.
Yeah. And I'm not.
And I think your point of everybody, the percentage of the pie remains the same, and what we're trying to protect is that formula. Right,
that's true.
It's not that we're trying to say if everything else decreases, we still want our
X amount of dollars.
We will grow and shrink with the same percentage that everybody else builds at the same time.
But if I can also, I think it's really a PR approach is what I'm trying to get at. We can't. The language needs to be carefully chosen that doesn't suggest
that we're asking to be held harmless.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and we've used that phrase several times here. We're not asking to be held harmless. We're asking to share proportionately and justly in the reductions that are going to be necessary. If there's less money, we're going to get less money. And we know that. Fight hard, but just go in so that we demonstrate to the legislature that we understand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's any city in the state that should be able to project some sort of empathy here and being able to understand, it's us. So I think that's all I'm talking about is perception and attitude and word choice is critical, not, frankly, to pissing them off.
Right.
Because if we piss them off, you know, they can change the percentage.
Mm-hmm.
And they may still well, but I think we're better off if we go in. You heard me. That's enough.
Councilmember Truitt.
I just want to understand it better. So are you telling me that we collected income taxes 2 years ago? Where'd the money go?
Vice Mayor, Councilmember Truitt, it's held at DOR through the state's been gaining interest on that collection for the past 2 years.
They hold on.
They hold on to it.
Okay, so they didn't like spend it, and now they're paying it back. The money is there, sitting in an account.
There's a lockbox. Is that what you're telling us?
That's the concept, whether it's reality or
like not. Well, that's my point. That's my point, I suppose, is if they had spent it and now we're asking them to pay it back, I could see that they'd have real grief on that in a year where they have less revenue. But if it's sitting in a fund, then that's a different story.
Yeah, and Vice Mayor, Councilmember Truitt, one thing that we're seeing come out of JLBC is that they're recommending somewhere, well, they've listed as possible options up to a $17 million cut in actual revenue sharing, the urban revenue sharing. That doesn't get into the possible $100 million transfer from HERF to DPS and some of the other things that are on the table. But out of the actual collected income tax, they are proposing, or they are listing as an option. I don't want to use the word proposing. They have an option of up to $17 million that they will consider not passing along to cities and towns. So that's what we're looking at the moment.
And I think the other thing we say is we get a little confused when we say, well, we collected this at a time when they had this budget surplus. I don't think it matters one way or the other when we collected it, because this year they're probably going to collect state income taxes more than what we're even talking about, because the population continues to grow. Our unemployment rate is at 3%. All of this other budget stuff may have something to do with it, but I still think state income tax revenue is probably increasing every year.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
That, Vice Mayor, Councilmember Truitt, absolutely. I think what makes this unique is that this was a pre-appropriated amount, and almost to Councilmember Rawls's point just a moment ago, most years and in future years we'll be fighting for the voter-approved number, the 15% number. This year, there was a concerted effort and an agreement made at the highest levels of the legislature that there was a precise number, a number that corresponded with the number that the legislature felt good establishing and the number that cities and towns agreed to, because ultimately many of us, including the city of Mesa, did not want to stand in the way of how they wanted to deal with tax cuts or any of the other things to stimulate the economy. So we did not do that, but there was an agreement reached, and so we just want them to honor that agreement as it relates to urban revenue sharing for this 1 year pre-appropriated amount. And then in the future, of course, we'll be asking them to respect the voter-approved 15% level. But that dollar amount, we are wanting to hold their feet to the fire this year.
And let's make the point that as those state revenues increase, because there's a higher number of people in the state, that we then have to serve a higher number of people. We have to serve more students in the schools. And so there's an offset there in terms of the revenue, too. And that's, you made the point, Scott, that I was going to make, that this year has been, the revenue this year has been unusual because of that agreement that was made when the state legislature went in to cut the state income tax. The cities and towns, and as you said, the people at the highest levels of the state legislature got together and made an agreement that was different that made this year different than other years, which makes your point, Tom, a little more complex this year, because that's the point that we've made year in and year out. Just maintain the percentage. We understand that the pie is smaller than it was anticipated being, but we'll share that smaller pie at our percentage. This year is just slightly different than that because of what was negotiated a couple of years ago with the change in the state income tax. And Tom, did you want to respond to that?
That was sort of a set-aside number. I mean, we're still getting our 12.8% that'll be paid in 2 years from this year's tax collection, aren't we?
This year's collection, I believe, it's still been pegged at 15. They haven't proposed to decrease the collection
15%.
From this current fiscal year. So we're still at 15%.
This $717 million, before you add on the 10, mm-hmm. was designed to compensate us for the reduction in the state income tax rate?
Correct.
It was generated allegedly a smaller pot, or at least a smaller pot than it would have been if they hadn't imposed the tax cut.
Correct. What the attempt 2 years ago when Vice Mayor and Councilmember Rawls, when this legislation was drafted, when the budget passed, was to find the number, to model out the number of what it would be had the income tax cut not been enacted.
Right.
In a good faith effort on both sides to try to move forward. Actually, what we've seen is this number is actually smaller. Once final revenues did come in, some estimates from DOR and that we've done through the league show it, the real hold harmless number may be somewhere around 740. So we are in the spirit of the agreement reached. Right. We think 727 is the number it should be.
And that's a deal that was reached 2 years ago, and we don't even need to review the.
Sure.
Councilmember Truitt.
How does that compare to 15% of the actual income taxes collected?
And Vice Mayor and Councilmember Truitt, that's the 740-ish number that the projections show probably would have been the 15% number had you not taken into account the income tax cuts. If you do take into account income tax cuts, and then look at what that baseline 15% would be, we're talking about around $710 million. So,
of which we get how much? 9%?
Roughly 9% based on our population as it relates to.
So we're looking at a $15, $17 million difference. 9% of that, so maybe $10 million, $1 million.
The rough numbers, and we know this is very fluid, so we hate to somewhere between maybe $1.5 to $2.5 million,
like maybe 1.6. I mean, 9.54% of the $17 million would be around $1.6 million for the city of Mesa.
If and let me just stress, if they were to enact the cuts that were listed as an option by JLBC, only if they enacted it. So we're hopeful that with working with our delegation, we won't.
Okay, what else do you want us to know before we wrap up here?
And that's right. The one last point we had, but it's really been rolled into this discussion, is the State Aviation Fund. For many years, Vice Mayor and Council, I wish Lynn had Cousy had been able to stay. I saw he was here earlier. One of the low-hanging fruit when it comes to patching budget holes has been the State Aviation Fund, and we really feel that's very unfortunate because of the good work that fund has done to stimulate growth and development at Gateway, and also not to mention its impact on Falcon Field. But as we've looked at projects, runway expansions, and taxiway development, including financing of public-public partnerships we've done with ASU and ADOT for the construction of ASU's aviation hangar, that's an important fund. So we'd like to see that fund remain as intact as possible, to Councilmember Rawls's point. And okay. And with that, Vice Mayor, any other questions, comments, concerns?
Thank you. Just one other question, and I'm going to ask it of Councilmember Whalen, if you don't mind. You wanted to make a point. You were not able to be at our committee meeting, and I believe you wanted to make a point about the 287G jailing training.
Yes, We had a meeting with the ICE folks about a month ago, and they gave us a report that they would like to be able to provide us with dollars federally for 287G training for our jailers or someone for officers to work in our detention facilities. It's my understanding that the Sheriff's Office has used up most of the 287G federal funding to the tune of training 158 deputies. I had a chance to have a conversation with the sheriff, and I asked him if he'd give us one, and he said he had them all tied up. So obviously that's not going to happen. But is it possible that the state could look at a partnership with the federal government in reference to placing dollars or a partnership of dollars to get our detention officers trained in 287G immigration funding or in immigration enforcement? And the purpose of that would be that when we bring a person into our jail who we've arrested for a crime, oftentimes if it's a misdemeanor crime, we let that person go because we don't have appropriate resources to check immigration status, nor do we have any other reason than to just cite and release. Well, our court tells us that our show-up ratio is getting poorer and poorer all the time. So if we had a method in our jails, which I think is the best way to enforce immigration at this point, to have those fundings available, I think it would be worthwhile for the entire state.
Vice Mayor and Councilmember Whalen, we've been working with the city manager and with Chief Gascon and looking at really two options. One, certainly we can definitely have some conversations at the state and see if that's a possibility. To this point, our effort's been focused on looking at what the appropriations bills in D.C. are looking at, looking like. We know that the Senate in particular has added additional funding for 287G programs, and so what we've been working in D.C. to find out is the criteria for that program, if that's going to any certain criteria puts you at the head of the line or not the head of the line for getting that funding, and then ultimately the question we all want to know is when does the appropriations process finally come to a close in D.C.? As you know, the President and Congress are at different points on spending points on that. So those are all the factors we're looking at right now, but I think absolutely we can look at the state component of that and see if the state might be willing to partner with local communities.
It's my understanding even the Get 'Em Task Force put on by DPS has 287G trained personnel on that task force. And, you know, I don't think we're out of line by perhaps asking for one or two or three or four people be trained to. And I still think that the jail is the best place to screen people. And that's, you know, pursuant on the fact that this council wants to move forward with 287G enforcement, which we haven't really talked about in earnest in some time. Thank you.
This is saying here a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on the 2008 state legislative agenda. Mm-hmm. And I am in concurrence that I'd like you to pursue that, you know, dual track that, do it with the feds, do it with our state legislature. I don't know what kind of direction can we give direction on this. I mean, it's posted. I think you've heard a lot of direction here from the council. Can I just go around and ask, you know, if we're okay with pursuing that as well?
Yes, Vice Mayor, you can add or modify the written presentation that's been given to you.
So you've got two people who are wanting you to add that to the agenda that we've talked about. Councilmember Rawls.
I guess there's a bigger question, and that is the whole legislative agenda, and I would support moving forward with the legislative agenda as you have proposed it, with the addition of the detention 287G potential funding, not on the street yet, because I don't want to detract our enforcement efforts into that area, but I also would also ask that the my recommendation of going forward with the legislative agenda includes my PR approach to the budget issues.
Thank you. Mr. Whalen, did you concur with the rest of the legislative agenda? You're all right with that?
Yes, ma'am.
And with
you.
The PR approach? Yeah. Councilmember Truitt?
No sense in making a man.
And the same issue with 287G, you're okay with the jailing thing?
Yes.
All right. So I think you've got unanimous agreement, and I believe if the mayor were sitting here, he would absolutely agree with that. I haven't had the opportunity to talk to Councilmember Summers, but the things he said in the past would lead me to believe he would also be in agreement with that.
Absolutely. And Vice Mayor, just one final thing, too, just for the council's information. We'll be coming back in mid to late January to talk about our federal program. We're obviously 287G funding for the holding facility would be a component of that based on the comments we've heard from council. So,
thank you. Anything else on that one before we let you go? All right. Thank you very much. I'm moving on to item number five, which is to acknowledge receipt of minutes of various second. Boards and committees. I have a motion and a second. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? That was unanimous. Hear report on meetings and or conferences attended. Anybody? Yes, Councilmember Jones.
It was my privilege last night to be at the graduation of Class 42 of the Citizens Police Academy and the very wonderful program we have. And congratulations to those graduates.
Okay. I have two items. One is that last evening I was at the opening of the new Phoenix Children's Facility, which is on East Main Street in Mesa, out around, I want to say Higley. It's 5100 block of East Main Street. I'm saying Main, and I mean Southern. Boy, people are going to go to the wrong place. The 5100 block of East Southern in Mesa. This has a particular place in the hearts of my family members, as our youngest daughter was actually, her life was preserved by Phoenix Children's Hospital 20 years ago when she was born prematurely, and she spent 3 weeks in the NICU there with our not knowing whether or not she was going to live or die. And thanks to the good work of the people there and the expertise that they have, we have a 20-year-old now. And so we make a point of donating to them every year, and they do a lot of great work, and they're going to expand that work here. So we're glad to have them. Additionally, I have been getting razzed via email, via staff members, over apparently a front page picture that was in the Arizona Republic Mesa section this morning. Can I just say that I like singing, and I get enthusiastic about good causes, and I happen to be out with the bell ringers from the Salvation Army the other day, and an Arizona Republic reporter caught me in the act of having joy singing. So, but the Salvation Army does good work in our community, in the broader community, and so I was there in support of their efforts. Any other reports on meetings or conferences attended? All right, scheduling a meeting or general information. Yeah. Thank you, Brian. I know. I've seen it. I've been told. Mr. Brady, you're on. Brian's holding up a picture back there.
You will not find a picture of me singing, so that would not be good. Just a reminder, we do have a council meeting December 3rd, and that will be preceded by an Audit and Finance Committee meeting, which we're scheduling for 3:45 on that same day. And then we have our regular study sessions December 6th and December 13th. The December 13th study session will be followed by a Transportation and Infrastructure Committee meeting. That's on the 13th. Thank you.
All right. Are items from citizens present? Do we have any speakers?
No speakers present.
All right. I'll take a motion for adjournment. We have a motion. We have a second. And on a standing vote, we are adjourned.